From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tens of millions of dollars of reconstruction aid in Iraq have been wasted. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Stuart Bowen, Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, about the findings in his new quarterly report investigating waste, fraud, and security problems in the reconstruction efforts. The new film Breach is about Robert Hansen, the FBI agent who pleaded guilty to 13 counts of espionage in 2001 after selling secrets to the Soviets. We'll talk with the film's director, Billy Ray, and with former FBI operative Eric O'Neill, who was assigned to spy on Hansen and draw him out. In the film, O'Neill is played by Ryan Phillippe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the Special Investigator General for Iraq Reconstruction, Stuart Bowen has been uncovering waste, fraud, and corruption. His office audits how private contractors in Iraq are using money from America's Iraq Relief and Reconstruction Fund, the IRRF, or IRF. Bowen has just released his 12th quarterly report. The Iraq Relief and Reconstruction Fund's initial $21 billion budget is all under contract, and the fund's phase of reconstruction is coming to an end. But as part of President Bush's plan to stabilize Iraq, he's asking Congress to approve $1.2 billion in new reconstruction aid. We asked Bowen to talk with us about his latest findings. Stuart Bowen, welcome back to Fresh Air. What would you say the headline of the new report is?
The headline of this, our 12th quarterly report, is the end of the Iraq Relief and Reconstruction Fund in the beginning of the next phase. The Iraq Relief and Reconstruction Fund, or the IRF as it's called, was appropriated by Congress in 2003 for the recovery of Iraq, post-war Iraq. Amounting to $21 billion, it is now all under contract and over 80% is spent.
So what does that mean? Why is that the headline?
What that means is the largely U.S.-supported phase of the recovery of Iraq is coming to a close. The next phase must include a larger multilateral component, and ultimately it must transition rapidly to Iraqi control and Iraqi funding.
So our money is basically spent on reconstruction projects.
That's right. The money that Congress had appropriated for this program is basically spent.
Now, Iran, the ambassador from Iran to Baghdad recently said that Iran is prepared to offer Iraq training for its security forces, as well as equipment and advisors, and Iran is also ready to help with reconstruction. What can you tell us about the role that Iran plans to play in Iraq's reconstruction now that American money is coming to an end?
Well, we don't obviously have a role in reviewing issues like that, but what I can say is that support for Iraq must be multilateralized. An international compact for Iraq, which includes the Gulf states, the EU, and other nations, will, we expect, realize the hope of Madrid. In 2003, non-U.S. Pledges amounted to over $13 billion, but just over three have come in to date. That must change this year for Iraq to move into the next phase of its recovery.
I know it's not your position to decide what's paradoxical, but do you find it a little paradoxical that as the United States' relationship with Iran continues to deteriorate, Iran seems to be forging an alliance with Iraq?
Well, Iraq is now a sovereign nation, and its government can make and pursue whatever relationships it chooses. But what's more important is that the world community move off of the sidelines and into the reconstruction game, the recovery game in Iraq, to bring this country forward and so that it can prosper.
One of the things I certainly take away from your report is that it's very difficult to do reconstruction work when there's so much fighting and sabotage. For example, electricity. Your report says that Baghdad is getting an average of 6.5 hours a day of electric power because of attacks on power lines that feed the capital and other political issues that inhibit the transfer of power from large plants in different regions of Iraq. Can you talk a little bit about how sectarian divisions and the insurgency is affecting power and other projects like that in Iraq now?
Yes, infrastructure security is a serious issue and has been for over a year now. It's an item that we identified in our spring 2006 report as requiring attention, and later last year, $325 million was appropriated to bolster the strategic infrastructure battalions that are needed to protect those power lines. But they have a long way to go, obviously. The attacks by the insurgents continue to hinder everything in Iraq, but especially the provision of basic services, electricity, most notably in Baghdad. Indeed, the Minister of Electricity told us last quarter that he has a difficult time getting his repair teams out to address the interdictions by the insurgents, because those repair teams themselves come under fire.
Now, your report says that more than 5,100 schools have been rehabilitated or constructed, and 6,800 secondary school teachers have been trained since 2006. But there have been problems with violence there, too. What are some of the problems with violence that are undermining the accomplishments of the schools that have been built and the teachers that have been trained?
Well, it's very difficult in Baghdad to do anything, including go to school. In fact, one of my interpreters was attending Baghdad University, and she told me that the Sunni students, when they come to school, have to come with bodyguards because of the danger. And moreover, that school had been reduced to 2 days a week because of the number of attacks and uprisings that had occurred around the university.
Can you give us an overview of the amount of money we've spent on projects that have been destroyed by sabotage or by the insurgency?
Well, it's a very small percentage of projects that have been lost, that we've constructed, that have been lost to the insurgency. Certainly many have been descoped or curtailed because of it. There have been instances where certainly there was a police station in Al Hilla that we constructed that got blown up and then we rebuilt it. But that is the exception rather than the rule with respect to U.S. projects. Indeed, my inspectors have visited over 90 projects in Iraq over the last 2 years and have found about three-quarters of them have met contract specifications.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stuart Bowen. He's the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction, and his office looks into fraud, corruption, and other abuse in Iraq reconstruction projects. And the office has just issued its 12th report. The issue of accountability comes up here, and I'm going to give you an example of what I mean. There were two whistleblowers who worked for Custer Battles. Custer Battles was a contractor in Iraq. And the whistleblowers sued the company for fraud under the False Claims Act. Custer Battles had provided security at the Baghdad airport and other U.S. installations. Now, a jury found that Custer Battles committed 37 separate acts of fraud and submitted $3 million in false claims for security arrangements in Iraq. The jury decided that there should be a $10 million penalty against Custer Battles. But then the ruling was overturned by a U.S. District Court judge who ruled that the Coalition Provisional Authority wasn't really a U.S. entity, and therefore the False Claims Act didn't apply to it. Would you explain that ruling a little bit?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate ruling because it has some grave implications. That is, those out there who may have committed fraud in connection with CPA will likely raise the same argument if they are prosecuted civilly or criminally under U.S. law. So I don't agree with that decision, and it, as I said, could present problems down the road.
So according to this judge, any contractor who was hired by the Coalition Provisional Authority would not be subject to U.S. laws because the CPA isn't a U.S. entity?
According to this judge, however, the CPA was constituted by order of the CENTCOM commander, and the administrator of the CPA was appointed pursuant to order of the President of the United States. Therefore, it has all the indicia of a U.S. entity. It was governed by U.S. law, wherein CPA internally, I should say, and CPA developed its own laws, which largely mirror U.S. law with respect to managing the interim Iraqi government.
So I think that this case is being appealed. Do you think it stands a chance of winning on appeal?
I do think it does. I think that the facts belie the decision by the judge.
So although a judge overturned the jury's verdict in the Custer Battles case, there is a case of corruption that has come to the courts in which the person was found guilty. And this was, a case that the decision came down this week. The person in question is Robert Stein. I want you to describe who Robert Stein is and what he was convicted of.
Robert Stein was the comptroller for the South Central region of the Coalition Provisional Authority. So he was in charge of $120 million in reconstruction funds, Iraqi money, that was allocated by CPA to that region for rapid reconstruction programs. He entered into a conspiracy, engaged in a conspiracy with Phil Bloom. Philip Bloom, a contractor who's also been convicted, who also will be going to prison, to essentially defraud the government of millions of dollars. And they had also in concert in this scheme, this conspiracy, were several military officers, including Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Hopfengartner, who's also been convicted and will be going to prison. Several other individuals cases are still pending, so I don't want to talk about those details, but it evolved from a hotline complaint. A citizen anonymously reported potential wrongdoing in Hilla, which is in South Central Iraq, and I deployed two auditors down there to investigate it. They returned with grim stories about potential wrongdoing, so I sent two investigators down, and thus began a long and detailed investigation in concert with other investigative agencies that fleshed out the facts of this fraud. It's the largest case that we have uncovered to date, but we have 80 other cases ongoing. 23 of them are at the Department of Justice under prosecution, and we should see progress in a number of those over the next quarter.
This is a really interesting case. I mean, you've got a private contractor, a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserves, and a member of the Coalition Provisional Authority working together in this fraud and corruption scheme. Like, what were their interactions?
Well, Robert Stein had the duty to approve payment on the contracts to Philip Bloom, and Colonel Hopfengartner worked with Stein in the contracting office, and essentially they agreed to pay Bloom for work that he never performed, or just to transfer money to him on contracts that really didn't exist, and as a result, Bloom recovered millions of dollars and paid them off in bribes.
What was the contractor actually supposed to be doing?
There were a whole series of projects. There was repair and reconstruction of the Babylon Police Academy, the repair and reconstruction equipping of the Karbala Library, as well as other facilities, barracks facilities down there. There was almost no work done on the Karbala Library, nor was any decent work done on the Babylon Police Academy. It was all deficient.
So, yes. So what kind of precedent? We have two separate precedents here. We have this trial where one of the people is found guilty, and then we have the precedent of the Custer Battles trial where the charges don't stick because they're overturned by a judge who says the Coalition Provisional Authority isn't a U.S. entity and is therefore not accountable to U.S. law. So what's the difference between these two trials and their perceptions of the Coalition Provisional Authority?
The difference between Custer Battles and the Bloom-Stein case is that the Custer Battles case was a civil action, whereas the Bloom-Stein case were criminal actions. And indeed, we accumulated so much evidence against Bloom and Stein that they agreed to plead guilty. They never had to go to trial. And that was true also for Hopfengartner. Other cases, however, are pending prosecution, and we'll have to see how they turn out.
My guest is Stuart Bowen, Special Investigator General for Iraq Reconstruction. He's just issued his 12th quarterly report. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stuart Bowen, the Special Investigator General for Iraq Reconstruction. He's just issued his 12th quarterly report investigating fraud, waste, and security problems. Well, you say in your paper that you think that there needs to be a kind of single authority coordinating all of this, and there isn't right now.
Well, the president just appointed a new reconstruction coordinator for Iraq, and I think that squarely addresses the problem we identify.
Mm-hmm.
And that the issue is when you have multiple agencies operating in a war zone trying to carry out a relief and reconstruction operation, you have jurisdictional lines bumping into one another. Someone who can cross those lines and coordinate those agencies with authority would make a huge difference in promoting efficiency in the program.
Do you have an estimate of how much money the United States has spent on projects that were never completed, or money that we've lost to fraud and corruption?
We don't have a number on those two issues yet to provide. We've been directed by the Congress to perform a forensic audit of the Iraq Relief and Reconstruction Fund over the next year and a half. And that's a very detailed, thorough review of every contract, looking at where every dollar went. And upon completion of that audit, we will be able to, with confidence, give you a number on it.
Do you have any guess about whether we're saving or losing money by investing so much in private contractors as opposed to having the military do the work?
Well, the military is doing a significant amount of work through overseeing the Commander's Emergency Response Program. $2.5 billion has been spent in that program to date, and it involves sort of military contracting officers engaging in direct contracts with local contractors. It has the salutary effect of quick turnaround, rapid effect that addresses local problems and puts local citizens to work. The shift has also moved from design build to direct contracting in Iraq. That is, we've moved away from using the very large contractors and are really fully engaged in employing Iraqis and Iraqi firms in the reconstruction program.
When did we do that?
That evolution began about 18 months ago. Virtually 90% of all new direct contracts have been going to Iraqi firms for the last 9 to 12 months.
Would you sum up for us what President Bush's latest plans for reconstruction are in Iraq?
Yes, they emphasize building capacity through the provincial reconstruction teams, both at the governance level and through reconstruction, by executing rapid reconstruction programs that employ as many Iraqis as possible. Unemployment is a serious problem, especially in Baghdad, and Baghdad is the target of these economic initiatives. Along with the PRT program is the Commander's Emergency Response Program. That's also aimed at employing Iraqis, engaging Iraqi firms, and trying to kickstart the Iraqi economy to get some attract some capital investment.
Do you think we should have done more of that early on?
I think it's wise to do it now. I think the SERP was something that began in the summer of 2003, and it grew sort of on its own as commanders recognized the need for rapid reconstruction projects in the villages and towns they encountered. Because of the successes experienced in 2003, it expanded greatly and continues to prove a good vehicle for investing U.S. dollars in Iraq.
You have a whole list of lessons learned. What's the most important one as far as you're concerned?
To ensure aggressive oversight from the beginning of any relief and reconstruction program after a contingency operation. I think that the lack of any effective oversight in Iraq from June 2003 till March of 2004 permitted people like Blumenstein to take advantage of what was an increasingly chaotic situation.
Well, I spoke with Paul Bremer when his book was published, and Bremer had been the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. And he said, in terms of like paperwork, paper trails for the money that he was spending, he said he gave out a lot of money without paperwork because you had to work in a real hurry. You know, there was a war going on. And in order to really get people to respond, you had to deliver quickly. And that, you know, in a war, in a chaotic situation like that, accounting isn't going to be as careful as it is in an office, you know, in New York or Chicago.
Well, I agree it's not going to be as careful in an office in New York and Chicago. However, it needed to be more than the standards that were met by the CPA. There needed to be some accountability mechanism in place, some reporting of how the money that was being transferred to the inter-Iraqi ministries was being used. And there wasn't. There was just a ledger that showed how much had been budgeted and how much had been delivered. There was no meaningful feedback on what happened to that money after it was delivered to the Iraqi ministries. And it was delivered in cash.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and have a safe trip.
Thank you, Terry.
Stuart Bowen is the Special Investigator General for Iraq Reconstruction. He's just issued his 12th quarterly report. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, with the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Harriet Jacobs's Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Anne and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The new film Breach is based on the true story of Robert Hansen, the FBI agent who sold secrets to the Soviets and pleaded guilty of espionage. We'll talk with the film's director, Billy Ray, and with former FBI operative Eric O'Neill, who was assigned to spy on Hansen and draw him out. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Breach is based on the story of the FBI agent Robert Hansen, who was convicted of espionage for selling secrets to the Soviets, drawing on his access to classified documents from the FBI, CIA, and National Security Agency. Hansen is now serving life in prison. The role of Hansen is played by Chris Cooper. Ryan Phillippe plays Eric O'Neill, the young FBI operative who was assigned to work as Hansen's assistant so that he could spy on Hansen and help the FBI find evidence against him. Eric O'Neill is my guest. He's since left the FBI and is now a lawyer. Also with us is the writer and director of Breach, Billy Ray. He also made the film Shattered Glass and wrote the screenplay for Flight Plan. Let's start with a scene from the beginning of Breach. Special Agent Kate Burrows, played by Laura Linney, is briefing O'Neill on his new assignment, but at this point in the story, she's not revealing the real reason he's being asked to spy on Hansen.
You're being tasked to headquarters. Well, you'll be riding the desk of an agent named Robert Hansen. You know him?
No.
Former head of our Soviet analytical unit. Considered our most knowledgeable analyst on Russian intel. Last 6 years, he's been our liaison at the State Department.
Sunday.
We're bringing him back to headquarters, where he's going to start our new Information Assurance Division, safeguarding the Bureau's IT system from cyber terrorism and infiltration.
Wait, I've heard of this guy. Was he the one who hacked into another agent's hard drive?
He's the best computer guy we've got. He's also a sexual deviant.
Oh.
Been posting on the internet. Lurid material. There are some complaints in his file from female subordinates.
I shouldn't tease you, but that just gets me into trouble.
You're going to keep an eye on him for us. It's not a glamour detail, sorry.
Eric O'Neill, Billy Ray, welcome to Fresh Air. Eric, let me start with you. What was your assignment in bringing down Robert Hansen?
Well, originally I worked for a small group in the FBI called the Special Surveillance Group. As an investigative specialist, I was a ghost. So I was, for the most part, behind a camera, watching targets by from the shadows. When I was tasked for the Hansen case, it was a unique experience because instead of being sort of behind the lens and at some distance, I was in the room with my target, face-to-face with an objective to get him to talk and see if he'd spill some of his secrets.
And what was your cover? What was your official story to him?
I didn't have one. In this very unique experience, they were worried that I might slip up if they gave me a legend. It wasn't something that I was particularly trained for. By a legend, by the way, I mean a cover story, a cover identity with a new driver's license and a whole background that you memorize to the most specific detail. They were a little worried about Hansen. He was too savvy and too able to get into the FBI's computer system. So they were worried that something might slip there. And so I went in as myself, which was nerve-wracking, to say the least.
And you went in as his assistant?
Yes. I was Eric O'Neill, his assistant. And the first day, he actually spun a legal pad around to me and said, I'd like you to write down your name, your Social Security number, your current address, your wife's name and birth date, and your parents' name. All this very intimate, very specific detail about my life that I was handing to him. And he told me, I need it because I'm your boss and I need to know these details. But in my mind, I was thinking he needs it because now he has something held over me.
And also he could investigate you.
Exactly.
He could check your identity. So he, in the movie anyways, Hansen really prides himself on being able to read other people carefully, to read their personalities, to catch them in any betrayal or deception. Was he that way with you? Did he make it clear to you that he could catch any kind of deception?
Very true.
That must have been so hard. I mean, here you are inexperienced at this game, and here he is very experienced at the game, and he thinks of himself as like the ultimate in ferreting out deception, and you're completely deceiving him. So what are some of the mind games that you'd end up playing with each other?
Well, when you're in that situation, you need to find a point of attack because you'll go crazy if you just believe that they're on you. So you look for that fact that says, I'm burnt, they're on me, and I'm in trouble. And there were only two people in that room, and I was the other guy, so he had to continually put pressure on me. And the biggest way he did that was by keeping me off balance.
Like how?
He did many inappropriate things, things that in an office environment will get you fired, such as looming over me constantly. If he was next to you, he would always kind of lean against you, things that made you uncomfortable and really threw off your body awareness. He could be harsh. He could be prone to rage at times and yelling and screaming, threatening. There were other odd things. His perversions came out while we were together in the room, and that was very complicated for me.
What perversions?
He would put you in inappropriate situations, some of them quasi-sexual. I didn't think any of it was homosexual. I think it was a sort of controlling environment. For example, it came out that he had this, and this is a little bit titillating, but he had this sort of obsession with Catherine Zeta-Jones, and we would find DVDs, and he'd watch the movies and you know, while he was supposed to be working and that sort of thing. So I had to deal with that, and I had to think, what game are we playing here? What is the response he expects of me, and how can I sort of throw this back at him and throw him? And in the end, I decided to just kind of push back. When he did something that really upset me, instead of saying, you know, and threatening him, I would just push back, like, get the hell off my desk, or, you know, leave me alone, or, you know, stop touching me that way. And he'd kind of chuckle about it, and I think that that's where he started to respect me.
Okay, and once you realize he is your target and you were going to catch him, what's the biggest catch that you got?
Well, the case, and it's portrayed perfectly in the movie, is the great Palm Pilot scene. That scene is very, very true to life, and almost exactly the way it went down, and all those tensions are exactly what I was feeling.
Can I ask you how to describe it?
Sure. One of my biggest tasks was to determine where he might keep his secrets, where those keys were that we could use to unlock his history of spying, and find ways to catch him red-handed. One of the ways that I did that was to observe Hansen and see where he kept things, what sort of things he kept on him. Well, he had this Palm Pilot he kept in his back pocket constantly. And I also realized that while he requisitioned a Palm Pilot for me from FBI Office of Technology, he got me a Palm 5 and he had a Palm 3. And he decided he didn't want to get himself a new one. Well, why wouldn't you want the flashiest new thing? Well, one, the Palm 3 was his own. Two, he had reprogrammed it and encrypted it. And three, he never let it off his body. It was always in his back right pocket. And he was very, very diligent in where he put it and how he always had it. He would sit down. He would put it on the desk next to him. His hand would always be near it. When he stood up, it immediately went in his pocket. So we had to find a way to separate him from this thing that's always like a part of his body, an extension of himself. We did that by getting some of the higher-up agents, people who were above him in the chain of command, to come in and challenge him to go shoot. And one of the biggest parts of Hansen's ego—
At the target range.
Right.
Yeah.
Is his ability with a rifle and a firearm. He was a dead shot marksman, and he had very proud of that. So they challenged him, and he said no. And they said, I'm sorry, I don't think you understand. This isn't a request. That flustered him. And he forgot to do that motion he made every single time he got up, grabbed the Palm Pilot, put it in his back pocket. I went to his briefcase, opened it up, grabbed the Palm Pilot, and ran down to where we had a tech team set up to copy the thing. They started copying the Palm Pilot, and as it happened, one of the guys that was down shooting with Hansen sent me a page on my pager, and it said, he's on his way back to you. He's out of pocket. And I thought to myself, wow, this is not good. I mean, I've got the Holy of Holies down here, and this guy's got 80% copied, and this guy, and Hansen is walking up from the basement shooting range up to the seventh floor. I was smart enough to have timed it. Like, if I ran flat out down the hall, caught the elevator the first second I hit the button, and it made it down without stopping at any floor, and I ran into the shooting range, it was a total of about 6 minutes. I said, I got 6 minutes, finish up right now. It took them another like couple minutes to finish, and then I was the one running all the way up those flights of stairs and into the office through this vault door that had three different locks and very distinct locks and into his office, kneeled down in front of his bag, looked at his bag, and realized I've just opened all four pockets, and I really don't know which pocket I pulled the Palm Pilot out of.
So what did you do?
I had to think right then. Well, I'd evaluate what I was going to do, because Hansen was coming in the door, and I heard the telltale key beeps of him punching in the code. And I knew I only had seconds. So in those seconds, I had to decide whether I was going to run out of there and give up the whole operation, but, you know, maybe get down the hall somewhere where he wasn't going to shoot me if he found out that I had messed with his Palm Pilot, or I was just going to drop it in the bag and play it off and hope. And in the end, I decided just to trust luck, drop it in the bag, made the sign of the cross, said a quick prayer, hoped really hard, crossed my fingers, zipped up those bags, and ran to my desk by the time that he got in. And it turned out I was right. But the worst part of that entire case for me were those moments when I was sitting at my desk and I saw him charge past me into the room, slammed the office to his door, and I could hear him unzipping that bag and thinking, if I got that wrong, I'm dead.
Would you literally have been dead? I mean, did he ever threaten you?
I can't say for sure. He certainly threatened me, and you know, very ironically, he had no tolerance for betrayal whatsoever. And he would constantly tell me that it is so important that I can trust you. That is a true line in the movie. It was very important to him, and betrayal was just never going to happen in his eyes. And it's quite possible that, knowing what we know now, that he did have every letter he sent to the Russians on that data card that went with the Palm Pilot, and in he had the drop date and the date of his drop date and the location on there. Everything we needed to completely finish this case was on those instruments. So he might have thought, well, I'm caught. It's over. You know, this guy is going to pay for what he did because my life is destroyed.
I'm speaking with former FBI operative Eric O'Neill. We'll talk with the director of the new film Breach after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the new movie Breach, which is based on the story of Robert Hansen, the former FBI agent who sold secrets to the Soviets. The other main character in the film is Eric O'Neill, a young FBI operative who was asked by the FBI to work as Hansen's assistant and find evidence against him. O'Neill is my guest, and so is the director and writer of Breach, Billy Ray. O'Neill is played in the film by Ryan Phillippe. Chris Cooper plays Hansen. I want to play a clip from Breach, the movie that's based on your story. And in this scene, Robert Hansen, the spy who's really a counter-spy selling secrets to the Russians, who you're trying to investigate, is talking with you, and that's all we need to know to hear the clip.
You know why the Soviet Empire collapsed?
Good morning.
I made a career studying them. They were smarter than us, more devious, more determined. So why did they fail? Godlessness. Atheism. I'm on my way to morning mass. You do remember what mass is, yes? Jesuits at Gonzaga taught you that much, didn't they?
Sir, my grandfather was a deacon.
Well, congratulations. Now it's time to join the varsity.
That's Chris Cooper as Robert Hansen, the now infamous FBI agent and Soviet spy, in a scene from the movie Breach. As we hear in that scene, Hansen considered himself a very God-fearing person and a very kind of strict Catholic. He belonged to the group Opus Dei. And at the same time, he, as you described earlier, he had a very active sexual fantasy life. In fact, according to what I read in the book The Bureau and the Mole, he had surveillance technology in his bedroom. And so when he had this old friend of his stay overnight, a male friend, mm-hmm. the male friend was able to, through the surveillance camera, watch Hansen and his wife having sex in their bedroom. I mean, that's the extent of how kinky he really was.
Yes,
and then
that's
he'd
true.
Write about this in chat rooms on the internet.
Yes, that all of that is true.
Did you know about that?
Yes, the video surveillance of him and his wife I found out later. In fact, I found out about that later as the FBI did after the case was concluded, after he was caught, and they tore apart his house and they found this stuff and interviewed his friend. And I had to call an agent and say, is this true? Because I read it in the media as well, and called, and yes, it's true.
Did you ever get to look him in the eye after you helped bust him?
No, I didn't. He was whisked away and hidden away from me. There was a point where you know, out of some sort of insanity, I asked, you know, would it be okay if I talked to him? I don't know why, but he, but they said, they told me, no, that would be a real bad idea because we're really not telling him your role in this, because the betrayal would cause him to say nothing more to us. And the most important thing right now, the critical thing, is to debrief him and find out what he revealed. And the last thing we need right now is for him to shut up.
Well, I'm speaking with Eric O'Neill, and he is the FBI operative who helped break the Robert Hansen case. And Hansen is the FBI agent who sold more secrets to the Soviets than any spy had ever given to the Soviets before. The movie based on this story is called Breach, and with me is Billy Ray, who directed the film and also directed the movie Shattered Glass. Billy Ray, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you want to make this movie?
Well, I'm fascinated by duplicity and fascinated by stories that are about integrity, and this certainly was that. But after I saw early drafts of the script, the initial writers were a pair of guys named Adam Mazur and Bill Rotko. I started to read about the Hansen case. And, you know, there were five or six books that were published on that case almost instantly after he was arrested, and none of them mentioned Eric O'Neill, because at the time Eric O'Neill was classified. So none of them could mention Eric O'Neill, and I thought, here is the worst security breach in American history, and a huge chunk of the story is totally unreported, which is there are 500 guys trying to capture, men and women, 500 FBI operatives trying to capture Robert Hansen, but one of them was locked in a room with him all day long, and that's Eric O'Neill, the guy that no one's ever heard of. That felt like a piece of history that ought to be captured.
So you decided to make the movie. You said you're interested in deception. I mean,
sure.
Your previous movie, Shattered Glass, is about deception, too. That was about a journalist who made up the stories that he tried to pass off as factual reporting. Why are you so interested in deception?
Well, there's a very selfish reason, which is that when you're writing a movie, you're trying to give your characters subtext. You're trying to put them in a situation where what they say is not what they mean, just because that's more interesting to look at. And when you're dealing with liars, everything they say is loaded with subtext, because nothing they say is the truth. I once learned from a very smart man that the function of a camera in movie making is to capture what the characters don't want to reveal about themselves. And in a movie like Breach, you just point the camera at Chris Cooper, and it is revealing what Robert Hansen does not want you to know about him. So just selfishly, it's easier to make a good movie about people who aren't telling the truth.
What kind of interactions did you both have during the making of the movie?
Well, he's a huge asset. I mean, you know, if you're trying to do a research-based movie, which this was, you know, this is gold, this guy sitting next to me. So I was going to interview him as much as he would let me. I was going to send a million emails a day while I was doing the research and rewriting the script. I wanted him there in Toronto while we were in prep. I wanted him working with Chris Cooper to do an imitation of Robert Hansen.
Did you do that?
Yes, I did.
Can you do your imitation for us?
Oh, God, no.
He never does it. He never does it on air.
Right,
He's very shy.
I'm shy. I get a little shy about that, but I can tell you how I did it.
Sure.
And really, Chris came up with it because we faced that same question. Can you do it? I was like, and he said, I'll tell you what. I'll just read the script. And you tell me, you know, whether I'm close or what I need to do. And then you read the script. And that's how we did it back and forth until suddenly he kind of got it and he was there. He had an odd accent to it. It was very sort of, you know, neutral America, his accent, kind of like mine, but with a little bit of Chicago that would just pop in the oddest words. And I think Chris got that. The other thing is the way he walked and the way he grumbled and the little twerks he had with his face. The idea being that Chris really was concerned about making sure that his portrayal of this character was one where, you know, some of the people who knew Hansen and his friends and family could watch the movie and say, that's something Bob does, or, hey, that's a quirk that makes me think this is the guy, and that this wasn't just an attempt at portraying somebody without any sort of research.
And Chris wanted to get those mannerisms right. He wanted to lean into you the way that Hansen leaned into you. And he wanted to invade your personal space in the way that Hansen actually did. And he wanted to walk Eric into walls, which he actually did. And I also wanted Eric around because I wanted him working with my production designer. I wanted him to comment on the details of the hallways and how the room 9930 looked. We brought Eric in on the day that we did our prop show in Toronto. In other words, the guy who does our props, he lays out 20 briefcases. And I said, Eric, which is the right one? And he picked it. And he lays out 30 guns. And I said, okay, which are the 10 you'd find in his car? And he picked those 10. If you have access to a guy like that, you're crazy not to use him. And I wanted him around. I wanted him around while we were shooting. I would have been happy if he would have stayed there every single day.
Why is it important to you to, when possible, choose like the right briefcase or the exact same gun or, you know, whatever that was used in reality?
Well, there are two reasons. One is certain things are just a matter of historical record, like being able to shoot the scene of his arrest at the exact corner where he was actually arrested and to have people swoop in exactly the right way. You want to get that stuff right if you can. The second is, and this is just more of a selfish motivation, I want to be able to go up to my actor and say to him, we're not playing around here. This is the briefcase. These are the guns. This is the real world of this guy. It makes a difference when you're with good actors. They feel it, and they incorporate it into their performance. There's a reason why Chris is so good in the movie. There's a reason why Ryan is so good in the movie, because we surrounded them with things that were tangible that came out of that world. And all of that gets tucked into the performance of a good actor.
My guests are Billy Ray, who wrote and directed the new film Breach, and Eric O'Neill, a former FBI operative who's portrayed in the film. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. The new film Breach is based on the story of FBI agent Robert Hansen, who was convicted of selling secrets to the Soviets. We've heard from Eric O'Neill, a former FBI operative who's portrayed in Breach. My guest Billy Ray wrote and directed the film. What are some of the most mysterious things to you about Robert Hansen that you'd actually really like to know but you can't find out about?
Well, there's nothing about him that's not mysterious, at least for me. I really wanted to sit down and talk to this guy while I was writing. That would have been amazing. Of course, the FBI said I couldn't. So
he's in solitary confinement.
Yeah, he's in a supermax penitentiary. He's not getting out, and he's certainly not talking to me. But I asked the FBI for permission to submit written questions to him, and they said that was okay.
Oh, really?
And
did you do that?
I wrote 15 questions and submitted them to the FBI, and they passed 14 of them along to Hansen. And he declined to answer any of them. I tried it twice.
Oh, what were some of your questions, and which was the one that the FBI declined to pass on?
The one that they declined to pass on was, if you ran the Bureau, how would it run differently? I guess they just didn't want him answering that question. But I asked him questions like, what did you think of Eric O'Neill when you first met him, and how did your opinion of him change? I asked him, why did you make that last drop? If you had a sense that the FBI was on to you by that point. I asked him if he regularly confessed to the espionage, because we know that he was a very serious Catholic, and we know that he was spying for 22 years. Was he regularly confessing to being a spy, regularly receiving some sort of absolution, and then continuing to do it? And then I threw in a couple bogus questions just to pad it a little bit so that he wouldn't know exactly where I was trying to get my information. It didn't matter. He just has no interest in helping me.
Now, in Shattered Glass, your previous film about a journalist who is lying and makes up the stories that he writes, and in this film, Breached, about the spy Robert Hansen, a lot of scenes are shot in fluorescent lit offices, and there's probably like no more of a boring space to shoot.
Right.
But you have to make it interesting. You have to give it some kind of personality so that when we're watching fluorescent lit hallways and offices, we're seeing something that's going to hold our attention. Can you talk about the challenge of making movies in like uninteresting places like
yeah,
that, you know?
Well, step one is hire a great DP.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I had Tak Fujimoto, who had shot Silence of the Lambs and Signs. And he and I talked about trying to make this movie look like one of those great American studio movies of the 70s. The best example for me of that kind of look being The Paper Chase. And he understood that. I mean, we had a great shorthand about that. But my feeling is I look at a lot of the movies that are made today, particularly 2006 movies, where visually you can tell they were just all created by CGI. I mean, like every inch of the frame is loaded with some gadget or doodad. And yet the movies have no tension and they're not terribly interesting at all because they all feel like a gimmick. It's much more interesting to me to take a circumstance, even an office that has fluorescent lighting, and try to challenge yourself to make that interesting by making what's happening in the office interesting. Again, the tension arriving out of the fact that you know you're stuck in a vault, and how can that be an asset to us as filmmakers? There's a moment where Ryan Phillippe walks into that office for the first time, and he shuts the door behind him, and he just hears that, he hears the way it shuts. And it's a moment that plays on his face of, okay, I'm stuck. I'm in here. No one's going to hear anything that happens inside this room. And like Eric was saying, if this guy decides to shoot me, no one's even going to know. No one's going to hear it outside. That's an opportunity to take something that could be very dull and make it an asset of the storytelling. We looked for that kind of thing all the time.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having us. It was an honor.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Billy Ray wrote and directed the new film Breach, which will be released in February. Eric O'Neill is a former FBI operative. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Sight Unseen, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
13 journalists have been murdered since Russian President Vladimir Putin took office. The Kremlin is widely believed to be behind some of those and other recent murders. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Spector about his recent New Yorker article, Kremlin Inc., Why Are Vladimir Putin's Opponents Dying? I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.